been talking about for loops. You remember that if I, for example, say for I equals 1, I less than or equal to 10, I plus plus, then I say something like C out I. This will do what? This little piece of program. What will this program do? For I equals 1, I less than or equal to 10, I plus plus, C out, I, end line. It'll print I, it'll print, go ahead. Right, I'm not saying how it works, just summarize what does it do. That's it, just prints out the number 1, and does what? So in other words, summarize that in one sentence. It prints the numbers from
1 to 10.
Very good. Prints the numbers from 1 to 10. All on the same line or each on a separate line? Each on a separate line. Every time we do the end line, it'll go to the next line. So we print the numbers of 1 to 10 each on a separate line. This is actually quite simple. Suppose I do the following. For I equals 1 to 10, which is what this really loop does, right? For I equals 1, I less than or equal to 10, I plus plus. And then I say, for j equals 1, j is less than or equal to 5, j plus plus, c out, I, j, end line. This program, or these set of statements, is called a nested loop. I've seen nested loops before when we put loops, a while loop, and for loops together. But here we have a nested set of for loops. This is what we call the inner loop. And this one is the outer loop. Now let's trace this thing through and see what it does. Can anyone see what it does, by the way, without me tracing it through? Can you guess at what this loop would do? Let's trace it first. We start out, what do we start out? I is 1. Okay, so hold that. I can write it down. I is 1. And so that's less than 10. So then we're going to enter and do this. What does this say? For j equals 1. So j is 1 now. Is j less than or equal to 5? Okay. C out I space j. So it's going to print out a 1 and a 1. Now remember what happens. After we do this, we're back to here. So now what happens? J becomes 2. Is that less than or equal to 5? So then we do this, which says print out I and J, which prints out 1 and 2. And again, we come back to here. And J becomes now what? 3. Is that less than 5? So we'll do this again. Print out I and J. Come back around. J now becomes 4. Is that less than 5? So we'll do this again. Print out 1 and 4. Come around again. J becomes 5. That less than or equal to 5? So we'll do this again. Print out I and J. We come back around. J now becomes what? 6. That's not less than or equal to 5. So we drop out of this loop, but that takes us back to here. And I now becomes 2. And now we get to this statement again. So what is J now at this moment? J becomes 1 again. Exactly. And so now it prints out I and J, which is 2 and 1. Come around again, J becomes 2. Okay? Is that less than 5? So it prints out 2 and 2. Now, without going through it, how many times is this loop, or how many lines would I end up printing? 50 lines. Good. Because for each time this loop repeats itself, which it's going to repeat itself 10 times, this loop repeats itself 5 times. So the inner loop moves fastest. For each time the outer loop goes around once, the inner loop goes 5. Okay, so this will print 50 lines. What will the last set of numbers be that are printed? What's the very last set of numbers that are going to be printed? That's not the last, the very, very last line. 10 and 5, right? The very last line will be 10 and 5. Okay, now, this is a nested loop, and as you can see, the inner loop is completely considered to be within the outer loop. It is, should be clear to you that you cannot do the letter I over here. You can't have a nested loop which uses the same index variable. That's what it's called. The variable that's keeping track of the, how many times you go around the loop is known as the index variable, which is why, by the way, we start with the letter I traditionally for loop variables from the word index. This would not be legal because the variables have to be different. We have to have a separate variable to keep track of the outer loop where we're up to, and a separate variable to keep track of the inner loop where we're up to. So this is illegal, and therefore I will change it back to J. What must I and J have been declared to be? What must be the type of the letters I and J? Int, right? Because they're counters. They're keeping track of whole numbers, how many times we're going around the loop. So one can say, of course, before here, up here, one would say int ij. Often, the variables I and j really serve no other purpose than keeping track of what's going on in a loop. And so in C++, it is a common thing to do, instead of declaring it as you normally would variables, int ij, to make the declaration right inside the loop. For int I. For int j. Okay? In other words, it creates the variable just for the purpose of the loop. And in fact, remember we talked about local and global variables? The variable I now is only going to be known in this loop. Down here, we don't know anything about I. Similarly, the variable J is only going to be restricted to that loop. Outside the loop, we don't know what J is. And this is a stylistic way of avoiding, or first of all, being able to use I and J over and over again for different places, and having each of them being independent. So whether you do it up on top, int IJ, or you do it in here, it's really going to work exactly the same way. It's just a common convention to declare the index variables within the header of the loop. Now, let's take a look at the following structure. Suppose I say something like, for int I equals 1, 2, 1, I less than or equal to 10, I plus plus, open brace, match the closing brace for this for loop. And then I have some statements here. Then I have for int j equals 1, j less than or equal to 5, j plus plus, open brace, close brace, some statements. Notice how I indent the bodies of each one. Then some more statements. Okay? Suppose that was the way we had a loop. And I asked you the following question. How many times will this statement be done? This, what I'm pointing to up here. 10 times. This statement is not inside this loop. This statement is in this loop. It repeats 10 times. How many times do these statements get done? 50 times. Right? Because for each time, these statements are like the one over there. For each time this loop goes around, this loop will go around, this little loop here will go around 5 times. So altogether, these statements will be done 50 times. How many times will these statements be done? 10 times. Right? These statements are not in this loop. This loop is this. This is what goes around 5 times for every time this one goes around. This goes around 5 times. So these are not in here. These are not in here. These and these are in the outer loop. So So it does this one, this one, this one. Then it does this 5 times. Then it does this one, this one, this one. Comes back around again. Does this, this, this. 5 times. This, this, this. Come back around. This, this, this. 5 times. And so on. Does everyone understand that? Okay, look carefully at it. Make sure you understand how these loops go. It's like wheels within wheels, like the odometer in a car. Now, because you might have lots of statements here and lots of statements here, even if you line things up, when someone reads your program and they get to a brace, they may forget, what are we ending right now? So it's a good idea to add a comment here and say, end for J. And here I would put a comment, end for I, to help the reader who's reading your program know which brace ends which loop. Just as a matter of style. Obviously the comments are not essential to running the program, they're just essential for us to understand what the program is doing. Okay. Remember in the workbooks that you had in first and second grade, the black and white notebooks on the back of the covers, there was a multiplication table? Okay. It looked something like this. And so on and so forth. Right? Remember these multiplication tables? So that you would say, if you wanted to know what 6 times 6 was, you'd go 6 times 6, and it would be 36 would be there. Okay? I'd like you to write a few lines of code that would print such a table out. Okay? Now, before you start, where do I start from? Well, let's analyze this. How many lines does this table have? 10 lines, right? 10 lines. 1, 2, 3, all the way up to 10. And for each line, you have how many numbers? 10. So we have a loop within a loop. Now, if we're on the second line and the third column, how do we get the number to print here? We multiply second line, third column, 2 times 3, and get 6. When we're down to the 6th line, in our outer loop, 6th line, and we want to print out what's in the 10th column, how would we know what to print? We'd say the 6th line, 6 times the 10th column, 6 times 10 would be 60, and we'd print that. Okay? That should give you a clue on how you might want to set up your program. So why don't you take a few minutes out, to write just the statements. You don't need to write the main and all the other stuff. Just the few statements that will print out a multiplication table from 1 to 10. It has obviously a nested loop. Okay, let's continue. Let's look at this together. How many lines did we want to print? How many? 10 lines. So, for line equals 1, line is less than or equal to 10, line plus plus. And for each line, what do we want to do? We want to print 10 numbers, or 10 columns, right? So the next loop will be, for column equals 1, column is less than or equal to 10, column plus plus. C out. What do we want to print each time? Exactly. The line times the column. And of course we need to put a little space between that and the next number. So I will just put a little space like that. Okay? Now, if I leave the program like this, what will it appear? What will happen? Everything will be on one huge line. I want to start a new line when? Every 10 numbers. Good. So if this loop goes around 10 times, and then I say, C out, end line, look at the structure. We did this, this is from what I had before. How many times does this statement get done altogether? 100 times. Right? Because this will go around, this loop, the outer loop will go around 10 times, and for each time the outer loop goes around, the inner loop goes around 10 times. But how many times is this going to get done? This is not in the inner loop, this is in the outer loop. So how many times will this one get done? Only 10 times. After this gets done 10 times, prints out the first line, we'll start a new line. Then we come back around again, this will be done 10 more times, printing out the second line, this will start another line. Come around again, print the third line 10 times, 10 numbers, and then start a line. Does someone see that? Okay, make sure you understand that this will produce that table. So we have nested loops. Of course, it's also possible to have three loops, one within another loop, within another loop. There's no limit. Of course, it gets very complicated. But it's like your odometer on your car, right? The ones place goes around 10 times for every time the tens place goes around. The tens place goes around one time for every time the hundreds place, and so on and so forth. Everybody with me? Any questions? Okay, let's move on to a slightly different topic now. We'll come back, we'll be looking at these loops. Nested loops are very, very powerful, and we'll be using them all over. First, we need a little bit of an introduction. Prime numbers. Okay, someone define to me, what is a prime number? Never heard of prime numbers in math class? In high school, in elementary school? What's a prime number? You don't know? Exactly. A number that can't be divided by anything other than one and itself. So the prime numbers are 1, 2, 3, 5, 7, 11, 13, 17. Now, the issue is, how do we find prime numbers? Okay? So how does one do that? So let's say I ask you to print all prime numbers less than 50. Okay, what method would you use? So there was a Greek mathematician some 3,000 years ago whose name was Eratosthenes. Have anyone ever heard of him? And Eratosthenes came up with a method known as the sieve of Eratosthenes. Everyone knows what a sieve is, right? You filter, like you throw flour in it and it cleans it up, right? So what we need is a method that we put numbers into it, and it tosses out anything that's not a prime number. So this method, which was introduced thousands of years ago, if we want all the prime numbers less than 40, first you write out all the numbers. Just write them out. It doesn't make a difference how you write them out. You write them all out. Okay, and then you start. You circle the first number. It's a prime number. Done. Next number you hit, it's also a prime number. 2, by the way, is the only even prime number because all other even numbers are divisible by 2. Once you hit this number, you then cross out every next second number. So you just go ahead and cross them out. Next number you hit is a prime number, automatically. Whatever's left becomes prime. Now you cross out every third number. 1, 2, 3. 1, 2, 3. 1, 2, 3. Next number that's not crossed out, prime number. So now you cross out every fifth number. Next number you hit is a prime number. You cross now cross out every seventh number. That's a prime number. So now you hit every 11th number. Next number you hit is 13. So now you're going to print that, cross out every 13th number. Next number that's left becomes a prime number. The next number that you hit is 23, and so on. Okay? So this is a method that works. Is it a particularly efficient method? I think this is an efficient method for doing it? No, because first of all, you notice that we've hit many numbers multiple times. So we're reviewing the status of numbers. Instead of eliminating them once, we've gone through it multiple times. Secondly, if I had 1,000 numbers to look through, I'd have to be going through this at least more than many thousands of times. If I had 1,000,000, I would have to go through this millions of times. So this is a particularly not good method of finding prime numbers when you want to go through lots of prime numbers. Now, it would be nice if there was a formula. If I give you a number, you apply a formula and it tells you whether a number is a prime number or not. There is no such formula that is known today. Okay? So mathematicians, who have very little to do with their lives, like to play a game as who knows the biggest prime number. Just like mathematicians like to figure out pi to a billion places, again, because there's no formula, so it's a challenge to do that. There is a sort of a contest out there to find the next biggest prime number. One of the things about prime numbers, one of their properties, is that there's no pattern. Do you notice, for example, that first there are a bunch of prime numbers that seem to be near each other, then there's a bunch of spaces where there's no prime numbers, and if you go out into the billions and the trillions, you might find two or three prime numbers sort of near each other, and then may not find another prime number for another million or so odd numbers. Okay? So in other words, finding a prime number is a very, very difficult task, a large prime number, which is why it's a good contest. You get your name in the papers, you go down in the math books, but there's actually a practical reason to this, which I'll tell you in a moment. Let me give you an illustration on how difficult it is to find a prime number, or to determine whether a number is prime or not. Let's pick a number. Let's take the number, a small number, since I don't want to spend the rest of my life doing this. Let's take a number like 103 and ask, is this a prime number or not? Of course, a mathematician would not take the number 103. They would take the number 200 trillion gazillion 304. They'll pick some huge number, okay, and ask, is this a prime number? And if they would do this for each number, they'd find the next biggest prime number. How would you find out whether this is a prime number? Now remember, the sieve is not a good method. I could write out all the numbers from 1 to 103 and do the method, but that's very inefficient. If I got to the billions and the trillions, if you had to write out a billion and trillion numbers and just do that over and over and over again, even a fast computer would never get there. Yeah, but why divide it by prime numbers? Why are prime numbers have any special role in determining whether another number is prime? Doesn't. You can take a number. In fact, if you take two prime numbers and multiply them by each other, you get a non-prime number. So prime numbers are nothing special in terms of determining whether a particular number is prime. Any number? Well, how do you know you're getting the right number? Maybe you forgot a bunch of numbers. You wouldn't try any number. Even numbers? Well, I guess the first thing you would do is you would divide it by 2. And if 2 goes in, then right away you say it's not a prime number. And if 2 doesn't go in, that means you don't have to divide it by any other even number. Right? Because if any other even number would go in, so would 2. So once you eliminate 2, you don't have to. So now you have to try to divide it by the odd numbers. So you would divide it by 3, then you would divide it by 5, and then you would divide it by 7, and then divided by 9, and divided by 11. As soon as you hit a number that went in evenly, then you would say, oh, this number is not a prime number, toss it out and go on to some other number. Right? How far would you have to go until you conclude that it is a prime number? In other words, do I divide it by 2, 3, 5, 7, 9, 11, 13, 15, 17, how far do I go? Until you can convince yourself that it's a prime number or it's not a prime number. Do I have to go all the way up to 103? Let's think for a moment. In other words, very good. You have to divide up to the square root of the number. Because, think of it for a moment. Let's say the number was 100. So the square root of 100 is 10. For every factor under 10, there's got to be a matching factor on the other side of 10. So you have 2 and 50. You have 4 and 25. Okay? You have 5 and 20. You have 10 and 10. That's it. So once you go up to the square root of the number and you haven't found anything, then you know there's nothing going to be lying above it because you would have found its match below it. So you only need to go up to the square root of the number. Okay? So we need to go through the odd numbers up to the square, 2 and the odd numbers up to the square root of the number. Does everyone agree to that? Yeah. Okay. So that's the rule. The rules you would have to try 2 and then all odd numbers starting with 3 up to the square root of the number. If you found something that went in evenly, then as soon as you found that first number, you can stop, you can reject it as being a prime number. If you hit the square root and still haven't found anything that went in evenly, then you can publish it. This is now a prime number. Does that method make sense? A technical question. How do you determine whether a number goes in evenly? How do you know if a number goes in evenly? Let's say I give you a number, and I want to see whether 7 goes in evenly or not. What would my if statement look like? If what? What does it mean for a number to go into a number evenly? There's no and what did you do before you learned decimal points in third grade? In second grade? Ah, there's no remainder. So if, I said 7, right? So if 103 mod 7 equals 0, then it went in evenly. In other words, you mod the two numbers and look at whether the mod is 0 or not. And that tells you whether the number goes in evenly. Does that make sense to everyone? So now we know how to do that. Now let's see whether this is a particularly efficient process. It's the best process we have, but let's see if it's a how efficient it is. Or let's put it another way. Why is this such a big deal? We got very fast computers. Why don't we just have the computers do it? Okay, even if there are a billion divisions, a computer can do a billion divisions in less than a second. Okay? So why can't, what's the whole big deal here? Why is this such a big challenge? And why are people spending their lives doing this? Besides the fact that they have no lives, but I mean, other than that, why? Why is this so difficult? Well, I'll tell you the reason why is much more than just why, because mathematicians have no lives. There's actually an extremely practical dollars and cents that depends on this, which is the real reason why they do this, besides the pride. But let's see why we can't throw a computer on it. So let's say, just for argument's sake, that we're already up to really big numbers. Suppose someone gives you a particular number that has 128 digits in it. 128 digits, numbers. Okay? So how can I represent a general number that has 128 digits? It's rough in scientific notation, and if I want to talk about some number, I would say it's on the order of 10 to the 128th power. Right? So I give you some number, a single number, that's roughly that big. Now let's do an analysis. What we're doing here is something called analysis of algorithms. Every algorithm, every method that we've learned methods for finding the largest number of a group. Later on, we're going to learn algorithms for sorting numbers. There are many, many techniques that you will learn that you will use in programming. And when you develop an algorithm, a very important question is this a particular efficient way of doing it? Think about in your house. Okay, there's efficient ways of cleaning the house, and there are very inefficient ways of cleaning the house. Okay, a manufacturing plant has an efficient way of manufacturing items and an inefficient way, which can make a big difference in whether they make profit or not. So we look at an algorithm and we want to decide whether or not a particular algorithm is efficient. And that's the science of that, which is a mathematical branch of computer science, is called analysis of algorithms. That's such an important topic that you take, as a major, you would take an entire course just devoted to analysis of algorithms. It's CIS 23. And there are many techniques that one uses. Let's just look at this particular algorithm, the method that I just described on how to find a prime number, and let's see whether or not we can presume that a computer can solve this problem in our lifetimes. So let's figure this out. If there is a number that has 128 digits, the first thing I told you to do was to do what? Was to divide it by 2, which would eliminate all the odd numbers, all the even numbers, which means I need to check half this amount, right? So if someone says to you, okay, so 1/2 of 10 to the 128th power. No, I don't know whether it's going to be even or not, because it depends what number is in front of this. 10 to the 128 is just any number with roughly 120. It represents any number with 128 numbers. I just want to find out how many numbers are left to look at. If I have 10, let's take the number 10, and I divide it by 2 and throw those numbers out, how many numbers are left? 5, right, which I need to check. If I had the number 1,000 and I divided it by 2, how many numbers are left to check? 500. In other words, what happens is, just to look at this mathematically, 10 is 10 to the first, right? 100 is 10 to the second, right? 1,000 is 10 to the third. When you divide 10 to the second by 2, you get 5 times 10 to the first, which is 50. If you divide 10 to the third by 2, you get 500. 5 times 10 to the second. In other words, when you divide something by 2, you get 5 and one less power. Always. Therefore, when I divide 10 to the 128th by half, I will get 5 times 10 to the 127th. Correct? So that's how many numbers are left after I do one division. That's pretty easy to divide. I can take divide by 2. Computer can do that instantly. And that cuts out half the numbers. Leaves me only 5 times 10 to the 127 numbers to still look through it. I'm going to simplify the math, say 5 times 10 to the 127, that's approximately 10 to the 127th. I'm going to throw away the 5 times. Obviously it's 5 times less, but let's round it off, because we're just doing off-the-cuff estimation. Okay, now I told you that once you've eliminated the even numbers, what was the next step? You would start doing divisions by what? By all the numbers up to the square root. So how many divisions would I still have to do in order to determine whether a number with 127 digits is a prime or not? So when you take the square of a power, what do you get? In other words, what is the square root of 10 to the 4th? What is the square root of 10 to the 20th? Another way of saying that is, what is 10 to the 20th to the 1/2 power? What's the rules for multiplication of exponents? You divide by 2. In other words, this is 10 to the 10th, and this is 10 to the 2nd. In other words, so getting back to our number, if I take the square root of this number, I would get 10 to the 60, well, it's an odd number, so let's say 7 divided by 2 is 3 something, right? Let's downward estimate. Let's make it just 3, 63. It's a little bit more than that, but roughly 10 to the 63. So you need to do 10 to the 63 divisions to find out whether or not a single number that has 128 digits is prime or not. Let's see whether or not how long it would take you to do that. So I have 10 to the 63. Let's assume we have a really supercomputer that can do 1 trillion divisions a second. Okay? Now, our computers can't do 1 trillion. They can do, let's say now, 1 billion divisions a second. But let's assume next generation, or a big machine out there, 1 trillion divisions a second. You know what? Let's assume that we have even a faster computer. A computer that can do 1,000 trillion divisions a second, which does not exist today at all. Now, what number is 1,000 trillion? Who knows? A zillion, not important. But how would you write 1,000 trillion? 10 to the what? Not to the 10th power. Let's, come on, what's 1 million? 10 to a million? 10 to the 6th. 1 billion is? 10 to the 9th. 1 trillion is? 10 to the 12th. And therefore, 1,000 trillion would be 10 to the 15th. So let's assume we have a supercomputer, which we don't have, that could do 10 to the 15th divisions a second. How many seconds would it take to do 10 to the 63rd divisions? So what is the rule? What is that equal to? What do you? How do you do this arithmetic? You subtract, and therefore you get 10 to the... what? What's 63 minus 15? 10 to the 48th. Seconds. That's how long it would take to do that. Okay. Well, how long is 10 to the 48th seconds? Well, let's see. How many seconds are there in a minute? 60. How many seconds, minutes are there in an hour? 60. How many hours are there in a day? How many days are there in a year? Let's take 365. Again, well, that will, we know it's 3 divided by 1/4. Who's got the calculator? Pull it out. The question is, how many seconds are there in a year? So there is 31 times 10 to the 9th. Right? Because you said 31 billion, right? Does anyone agree with that? Is it 31 billion? Is that what it says that you calculate? So we have more than one person saying the right answer. Yes? Good. Okay. So 31 times 10 to the 9th is the same thing as 3.1 times 10 to the 10th, right? So this is about, since we're just estimating, 10 to the 10th seconds in a year. Okay? So it's going to take us 10 to the 48th seconds to do these divisions. And there are 10 to the 10th seconds in a year. So let's see how many years that would take. 10 to the 10th seconds per year. So how many years is that? That's 10 to the 38th years. How many years is that? That's more years that the entire universe has existed, by any calculation. Come to a conclusion here, a very important conclusion, that there are computer science problems that no matter how fast of a computer you have, okay, even if we have, I assume the computer that was 10 to the 15th divisions per second, but let's say in the future it'll be 10 to the 20th operations per second, okay, faster than the speed of light, which of course can't happen. We still have so many billions of years to go through this, okay, that we never get there. So this gives us, there's an important lesson here. Brute force does not always work. It's supposed to be a social statement as well, not in the world, okay? Brute force does not always work. That's what the Democrats say. The Republicans say it does. But in any event, there's an important lesson here with computers. Simply having a faster computer will not help you solve a certain class of problems. Now, that doesn't mean that there's no solution to this. People do find these things, and they got to use some very clever mathematical techniques. And while one computer, but suppose we were able to ask 1,000,000 computers to put them to work on this problem, and give each of them a separate piece of the problem to work on. Where does one get 1,000,000 computers? Over the internet. If I can ask 1,000,000 people to join me in this project, which can be done, I'll talk to you about that in a moment, okay, then I would have a chance, after several years of computing power, to solve this. So what's the big deal? Why is this so important? Okay. A very important need in the practical computer world is encryption. When you send a message to someone, you want to make sure that nobody else can read it. There's some messages you don't care about, but in the business world, you send messages from one person to another, or if you're a spy, you send one message from one person to another, then you want to make sure that no one can read it. In other words, you want to write it in a secret code of some kind. There's more to it. If you send a message to the bank telling the bank to withdraw $1,000, how does the bank know that it's you actually sending it? When you write a message to someone, Okay, how do you know that the message came from the person that they sent it to? How does one cell phone, when it talks to another cell phone, not pick up what other cell phones are talking over the same airwaves? There are, as you can see, very, very important privacy issues, money issues, based on coming up with encryption techniques that are not easy to break. For example, the music industry in the past has tried to encrypt the CDs that you buy in the store in an aim to not to allow you to try to copy them on your computers. Of course, it took about a 12-year-old 1 week to figure out how to crack that method. The video industry, when you buy or you rent a movie on DVD and you try to copy it, you can't copy it. Well, that is, unless you give it to me and I copy it in 30 seconds. Or another 12-year-old somewhere on the internet has beaten the whole movie industry into doing it. Such to the point that, for example, iTunes is now giving up on the concept of DRM, or digital rights management, and letting you buy music that you own rather than that you can copy and give, you know, rather than not being able to copy it. In other words, when we talk about music and video, that's a $1 billion business. But when we start talking about banking, we're not talking about $1 billion business, we're talking about $1 trillion businesses. And when we're talking about keeping your social security numbers and identity theft all private, that nobody who is on the internet can pick up a message that you sent from one place to another, you can see that everything we do with computers depends today, any practical thing that we do on computers today, depends on ensuring that messages get through without being overheard, that messages get through with their signatures intact, that we know who they are. Okay, privacy issues. All of these things depend on having some way of encrypting. Okay, encrypting a message. For example, another example is, you know, there people post their pictures on the internet. And then, of course, once they're posted, anybody can download them. And if they're particularly good pictures, people can then end up taking those pictures they stole and selling it under their own name to, you know, art places. How do you protect? So there are methods of embedding codes in a picture that can't be detected by anybody other than by its owner. Okay? So how do we do this? Okay? Secret codes, in other words, is big business. It's such a big business that the United States government has an entire agency, NAS, that does nothing else but try to crack codes and listen to messages, and banks are required. And it's a very, very, if you're interested in mathematics, this is one of the hottest topics in mathematics now, the topic of cryptography. Now, of course, I could do something pretty simple. I can give you a code. If I want you to send me a message, I can pick some, you know, code, send it to you, and say, whenever you use that code, to send a message back to me. Okay? And only you would know it, because I sent you that only that message. Of course, if anybody listened along the way as I sent it to you, poof, it would be gone. Then anyone can listen to my messages. So that doesn't work very well. Right? The spies in World War II would use code books, which they would have to get to the other side. You know, and if someone stole the code book along the way, the codes were released. So it's not such a simple matter. Here's what I would like to be able to do. I'd like to put out a key. Now, the word key means something that you use either to encode or then to decode, right? Now, usually in the past, and in fact, if you you know, read spy books and everything, the same key that's used to encode and it could be used to decode. However, there are encoding methods, mathematicians have found, that allow me to use one key to encode, another key to decode. Okay, now, if I give you two factors of a very large number, let's call them A and B, it is trivial for you to figure out what that very big number is. All you do is multiply A times B. But as I've just shown you, if I give you a very, very, very big number, a number with 128 digits, or in today's standards, a number with 256 digits, which puts us totally out of the realm. And I give you this number. I publish it to everybody. I put it on my internet. I publish it in private. And I say to you, whenever you send me a message, use this big number to encode your message. However, in order to decode the message, the mathematical technique requires the factors. I don't tell you the factors. I know the factors. I tell everybody the very big number. That means anybody can send me a message, because they can use that big number, and they encode the message. But only I, who knows how I created that very big number, knows how to decode that message, because the decoding technique requires the factors. Called a one-way encryption technique. I publish, at the bottom of every email I write, when you want to send me an email, I don't do this because I don't care if anyone reads my mail, but if this is what the banks do, or in their software, this is what it does. A number, a very huge number, that everybody who sends them messages, automatically the software, Chase Manhattan Bank software, WAMU software, automatically encodes the commands using that big number that they freely give out to everybody. Only their computers know the factors of those two numbers, which is what they need to decode it. Since it's trivial to take the two numbers and come up with that big number, I can pick two very, very big numbers. I multiply them. That's it. That happens myself. I then give you that result. You use that result, but you don't know how I created that number because you don't know the factors. And to figure out the factors, you would have to do computers working for billions of years, by which point you wouldn't need the money anyway. Okay? So the concept of prime numbers, large numbers, analysis of algorithms have great, great, great practical importance to anything. Before cell phones were digital, cell phones were analog. And it was a hobby that people had. You'd go down to Radio Shack, you'd buy a little scanner, and you'd sit in your house at night listening to everyone's phone calls. Just listen to all the guys and the girls talking to each other, you know. And you'd hear all kinds of real... I used to listen to Flatbush. I used to hear things that would... You wouldn't believe what we've heard. You heard people, married people fooling around. You'd hear every phone call. Because all it took was not... The two people didn't have to talk on the cell phones. Or as long as one person was sitting in their car talking on a cell phone, it was transmitting it to the cell tower. And if you're, it's just radio waves. And therefore, if you have, just like if you have at home a baby monitor, you often can pick up phone conversations with people down the block. Very embarrassing what you sometimes hear. When you hear them talking about you, it's even worse. Okay? Today, now of course what happened was that the government made it illegal for ham radios to have those frequencies in them. So every manufacturer of ham radios put in a little, resistor in there that cut those frequencies out, but also published papers and said, if you want to, all you got to do is take off the screw, cut these two things, and now you can, everyone, it was published. Everyone knew that. It wasn't illegal to publish it. It was just illegal to manufacture it with it in. So that's the way you did it. Now that phones are digital, okay, they can be encrypted. Your cell phone takes the conversation, encrypts it, sends it encryption over to the cell tower, where the cell tower then decrypts it and sends it on. Now if you listen in with the same radios, all you hear is noise, gibberish, because you don't know the code. It doesn't mean that it can't be decoded, but it's very, very, very difficult, and therefore this whole hobby has essentially died, because there's no easy way. You can't go into Radio Shack and just pick up, a $30 ham radio and listen into everyone's conversations in your neighborhood. So this is an extremely important concept. Everybody with me? So what are we going to do with this here in class? We're going to move on to a different concept. Not a prime number, but we're going to be interested now in what's called relatively prime numbers. A pair of numbers or a triplet of numbers. Are they relatively prime? What does that mean? Anyone knows what relatively prime numbers are? Relatively prime numbers are numbers that, although they themselves are not necessarily prime, share no common factors. For example, the number, 12, no, that's not good enough. 25 has factors of 5 and 5. and 6. Both of these numbers are not prime numbers. Right? Prime, 25 is 5 times 5, 6 is 3 times 2, 6 times 1. Yet there's no factors that are in common. What I want to do is to develop a method. This will be the most complicated algorithm we've gone through this semester, but it's mathematically interesting, to produce all relatively prime numbers that are less than 100. I want to look at every combination of numbers that are less than 100 and decide whether or not they are relatively prime. First of all, how many numbers would I have to examine? If I want to look at all pairs of numbers from 1 to 100, how many pairs of numbers would I have to look? If you have 100 items, if you want to find pairs of 100 items, Oh, no. Let's say you had 2 socks, red and brown, 2 pairs of socks. How many different combinations could that come about? They could both be red, they could both be brown. The left foot could be red and the right foot could be brown. The right foot could be brown and the left foot could be red. So how many combinations is that? 4. Right? So if you have 2 objects, and each one can have 2 possibilities, there are 4. Now let's suppose you had 3 pairs of socks, red, brown, and blue. How many different ways could you get them out of the laundry? 9 different possibilities. Work it out. Red, red, blue, blue, brown, brown, red, blue, blue, red, brown, blue, blue, brown. I already got confused, but you can figure it out. So what's the formula? If you have 100 numbers and you can take them in pairs, how many possibilities would there be? Now, what's the formula? What am I doing here? If there was 2 sock color socks, I did 2 times 2. If there were 3 color socks, I did 3 times 3. So if there are 100 numbers in the first slot and 100 numbers in the second slot, how many numbers would there be? 10,000 numbers. 100 times 100. Now, it is true that unlike the sock problem, in which a left red is not the same thing as a right red, when it comes to numbers, the pair 5 and 15 is the same thing as the pair 15 and 5. So there's really half as many in the case of pairs than 10,000. There's really only 5,000 numbers. Okay, but we'll overlook that for a moment. See the difference between numbers and socks? Because the order, it's called in mathematics, it's called an ordered pair as opposed to socks, right? Because left and right is different. That's called an ordered pair. When it comes to pairs of numbers, if we don't care about their order, that's an unordered pair, so there's half as many. Okay, you remember your combinations? You took this once, remember back in school? Big C with numbers 2, you know, up and bottom. Vaguely rings a bell. Ding-a-ling. Okay. In any event, so I need to, for simplicity, look through 10,000 numbers. That's a big job. How can I generate those 10,000 numbers? How can I generate those 10,000 numbers one at a time? What can I do? Now that you've learned a little bit C++, how can I go through 10,000 numbers? How can I generate them? Wake up, everybody. We started out this class, we generated a multiplication table. How did we do that multiplication table? It had 100 numbers in it. What did we do? We used for loops, right? An external loop. So if I want to go through all pairs of numbers from 1 to 100, I would go for first equals 1, first less than or equal to 100, first plus plus, for second equals 1, second is less than or equal to 100, second plus plus, put a brace over there and a brace over here. In this body of this loop will repeat how many times? That loop will repeat 10,000 times. And if I actually said, see out first, second, would that not print out all 10,000 pairs of numbers? Yes? So we now know how to create the 10,000 numbers. What I need to do is to come up with something in here that looks at a first and a second and says, yes, you are relatively prime, or no, you're not relatively prime. Once I come up with a method for given a first and given a second of deciding whether or not they're relatively prime, I stick it into there, and since that will make that churn around 10,000 times, it'll examine all pairs of numbers. Is that right? So we've changed the problem from having to look at 10,000 numbers to looking at a single pair of numbers. So now let's move to this board, and I'm going to ask you, given a particular pair, first, and another pair called second, and another number called second, how do I decide whether or not they are relatively prime or not? So when we're stuck now, let's, instead of using variables like first and last, let's use an actual number. Let's take the number, just for argument's sake, where the pick of one of the 10,000 numbers might turn out to be 9, and the other one might turn out to be 31. Let's pick two of the, one pair out of the 10,000 pairs that will be generated one at a time. Okay, what might you do? If I ask you, it's first and second, are those two numbers relatively prime? What might you do? Yeah, but how do I find which number? Well, let's try the following. Let's take the first number, 9. Let's have another variable called divisor and make divisor equal to the first number. And then let's say to ourselves, does this go into this evenly? Of course, the answer is going to be, at this point, yes. Since it went into this evenly, let's now see if it goes into this evenly. And of course, the answer is no. So let's now subtract 1 and go 8. And let's see, does 8 go into this evenly? The answer is no. So there's no point in checking to see whether it goes into this because it didn't go into this. So let's go and make 7. Does 7 go into 9 evenly? No. So again, we'll go down to 6. Does 6 go into 9 evenly? No. So we'll go down to 5. Does 5 go into 9 evenly? In other words, does divisor, first mod divisor, is that equal to 0? And the answer is no. So let's keep on going. 4. Does 4, is first mod divisor equal 0 now? No. Does 3 go into 9? Yes. In that case, let's check to see if 3 goes into 31, which it doesn't. So let's go down with 2. Does 2 get into 9? No. So let's go down to 1. Ah, I got all the ways down to 1. And I didn't find a number that went into both. I can print the message, first and second are relatively prime. Let's take another number. Suppose as one of those numbers, the number was 33. Now let's start. Again, we'll make divisor always equal to the first. So divisor is 9. Does 9 go into 9? Yes. Does it go into 33? No. So we'll subtract. Does 8 go into 9? No. Does 7 go into 9? No. Notice there's no point in doing it. Does 6 go into 9? No. Does 5 go into 9? No. Does 4 go into 9? No. Does 3 go into 9? Yes. So then does 3 go into 33? Yes. This is not 1. So therefore we immediately can stop and throw these numbers out of the room. They're not relatively prime. Toss them out and start and get another number to look through. So now I've got to take this method, which basically said, generate the 10,000 pairs. And we start out by saying, divisor is assigned the value of first. And then we go into a loop. And the loop tries to divide divisor into first. And if it does go in, then it tries to divide it into second. And if it finds a number that goes into both, but is not one, then we stop the process. Move on to the next pair. If on the other hand, we get all the way down to one, and we still haven't found a number that went into both, then we print a nice message. They are relatively prime. Who had a question? Okay. So now, let's look at such a program, which you have in your handout. And I want you at home, obviously, of course, you're going to study for the exam this weekend, but you're going to take two other numbers, different pairs, try this out to make sure you understand the method. It should be called relatively prime. Do you have it in your handout? Or should be near the very end of the, if not, I have to give you another handout yet. Did we finish everything in that handout already? Let me just see the handout. Yes, we did this. You get a new one today. Isn't that nice? Okay, I put these out of order, so the first sheet. So if you go to the second sheet, just fold it over, and there you'll find the program we're going to be discussing now. Okay, this is the program, which we're going to discuss in a minute. Just to show that it works, let me just run it. As you can see, it's a little too fast for you to read. As you can see, when it finally got down to the bottom, it told me such things as 100 and 100 are not relatively prime, 199 are relatively prime, 198 are not, 197 are, and so on. And of course, how many lines are here? How many lines do we have? There are 10,000 lines, okay? Of course, that ran by pretty fast. Remember I told you that Control C is the key you would use to interrupt the operating system? They kick in its bands and say, just stop. In Windows and on the IBM PC, Control S, if you're fast with your fingers, will temporarily freeze the screen. So you can take a look at it here in the middle. And you just hit any key and it continues. Control S again, freeze it. You got to be fast with your fingers. See how it's going there? And as you can see, it went through 10,000 numbers pretty quickly. Of course, so now you'll tell me, okay, big shot, let's see, go through 1,000,000 numbers. Let's go all check all numbers from 1,000 to 1,000. Let's review. In this case, I have 1,000, so let me recompile that. And you might want to take your watch out and see how long it takes. But you'll notice already that it's going to go pretty fast. It'll check 1,000,000 numbers. And this is a very slow computer I have here, two generations old. Of course, if I did it all pairs numbers from 1,000,000 to 1,000,000, that would we would go home before it would be finished, even this computer. Okay? Incidentally enough, one of the ways in which you measure how fast your computer is, okay, you know, when people build their own machines, they take great pride in saying, my computer is better than your computer. Just like that show on television now, my father is better than your father. A stupid show. American public are so stupid people. Okay, but in any event, I mean, are you smarter than a fifth grader? At least is halfway intelligent. But is my father better than your father? Is really as dumb as it gets. They deserve the governor they get having shows like that. In any event, so stupid. When you want to prove my computer is better than your computer, I build a machine, I want to know how fast it is. Because we call that benchmarking. Okay, when you want to measure where your computer fits in. There are programs on the internet, there's one particular program called SuperPi, SuperPi, which you can download for free. And what it basically does is it calculates pi to as many digits as you tell it to. 1,000,000 digits, 1,000,000,000 digits, and so on. And what you do is you run the program with nothing else running on your machine, and it does the calculation, then it prints how many seconds it took it to do that calculation. And so if my computer can do this, you know, in 1,000 seconds, but yours took it 1,005 seconds, my computer is faster than your computer. So these type of mathematical calculations are very artificial. They're not really measuring anything about how many times, how fast, you know, word processing is going on. It's not telling you much about games that you're playing, but it measures one aspect of the CPU. It measures the speed of its calculations, which is an important measure. And these type of calculations, notice that it's still going. You just got to go through 1,000,000 pairs of numbers. It takes a while. Okay, to do that whole algorithm. Remember, it's got to go through that whole algorithm, do all the divisions. The bigger the first number gets, the more divisions it's going to have to do. So it's going through actually trillions of divisions here, and eventually we'll go home. But I'll leave this in the background. Maybe it'll be finished by the time we're finished. Let's go back and make this, let me just make this back into 100, so that the next time I run this program, meanwhile it's running there in the background, it's still there. Okay, let's look at the algorithm. Let's look at the program. Then you can study this at home. Relatively prime pairs finds all relatively prime pairs from 1 to 100 inclusive. Relatively prime pairs are pairs of numbers that only one can be divided into both numbers. My normal includes normal namespace, normal main. And I have three variables here, right? First, second, and divisor, which are all integers. And I'm introducing a new variable here called possibly prime. And you notice that what is the type of the variable possibly prime? Bool, which means it is either true or false. What we're going to basically want to say is that numbers are innocent until proven guilty. We're going to start our loop by saying you two numbers are possibly prime. When I find that they're not, I'll say, false, you are not. You'll see why I do this in a minute. But again, I'm giving the two numbers, when we start out, we're assuming that they are possibly prime. As we go through the procedure, when we find that they're not, we'll make it false. That's a Boolean variable, and it's acting like a flag. Remember a flag? We've had flags before where we put numbers at the bottom to tell us whether to stop or to continue. Here we have a flag also that tells us whether we should print the message or not print the message. Okay? Let's see how it's used. So, how are we doing over here? Are we still doing this? Yep. We're almost done. Almost there. That board. Okay? For first equals 1, first is less than or equal to 100, first plus plus. For second equals 1, second less than or equal to 100, second plus plus. And then, remember, this, what I'm going to highlight now, all of this, is what's in that box. This is going to be repeated 10,000 times, or 1,000,000 times, whatever it is that we're doing right now. And it's going, this, what's highlighted, is what I set up, is going to be that board. So let's read what that board says. First thing I did was divisor equals first. I put a 9 here. Then I said, if first mod divisor equals equals 0, if that's true, then what did I want to do? Check to see if it also goes into the second. But if the number is down to 1 already, then I don't need to divide it into the second because I right away know they are relatively prime. So, if first mod divisor equals equals 0, if divisor equals 1, if I'm always down to the bottom, see out, first and second are relatively prime. Else, let's say the divisor went in evenly into the first, like 9 into first, went in evenly. But this is not 1. So what's the next thing I want to do? Check to see if this goes into this. So else, if second mod divisor equals 0, well, what happened when eventually I got down to 3, where 3 went into 9, and 3 is not 1, and 3 goes into 33, what happens at that point? We yell, guilty! You numbers are not relatively prime. And so that's what I'll do. Else, if second mod divisor equals equals 0, but it wasn't 1 because we wouldn't have gotten here if it was 1, then we print the message, first and second are not relatively prime. Possibly prime is now false. I say divisor minus minus, which makes the divisor go down by 1, comes back to the loop. And the loop says, while divide, repeat this, as long as the divisor is greater than or equals to 1, and they're still possibly prime. But since right now I just found out that possibly prime was false, false and true. Divisor is 3, so that's greater than 1. But this is now false. Drop out of the loop. Come back to the 4 and get another pair of numbers to work with. Okay? Now, what you need to do, okay, seriously, this is a very interesting program, but the algorithm, see, it's finished. What you need to do is to, number one, take some pairs of numbers and work it out on the board just from the method that we've talked about, and then to look at that program and make sure you understand the logic of the program. That's the most complicated program we've done this semester in terms of logic. There's no reason why you shouldn't be able to understand it. Are there any questions? Yes.
I don't know the first.
Don't. And if it's not? Okay. So now you're telling me, you're asking me, isn't it quicker? So the question is, now you're asking a different question. Is this the best possible algorithm to do this? And the answer is, we can do several things to speed it up. First of all, you're quite right that I should check to see which one is the smaller number and then switch the two of them. That's clearly will speed up this dramatically. In fact, if we actually sat with our watch, you might want to do that as an experiment. Write a program that sticking the two lines right over here, okay, and just say right over here, right there, right before that statement, right before you assign the divisor. You would say, if first is greater than second, and you have three statements, remember how we switched with three statements? We switched them by 3. That's number one. Okay? Actually, you don't even have to do that. You just make divisor equal to the less to the smaller one. But then you'd have to switch, because it's always dividing into first, so you'd have to switch that too. It's not so simple. It's easiest to switch the two numbers and then to do it. So that's one improvement on the algorithm. It would cut the time dramatically. You might not notice the time so much for 100, for 10,000, but on a million, it would cut it down dramatically. The other big improvement is to figure out how not to do all 10,000 numbers, because we really don't need to do 10,000. We only need to do half. That's a little bit more complicated of an issue, which I don't want to get into. So the answer is, will this work if first is bigger than second? Yes. Is it the most efficient way of doing it? No. But in general, our rule first is always let's get a program running first. When you write an English term paper, first you write whatever comes to your mind down. Then you clean it up and move things around and improve it. Okay? In this class, since we're first learning how to write programs, we're really not concerned with efficiency. Well, that was very smart, okay? But basically, in this class, what we try to do is to do things in the clearest way rather than necessarily the most efficient way. There are a lot of programs that, especially when we get to sorting, I will show you a very simple way to sort numbers, which happens to be a horrible way of sorting, efficiently-wise. When you're sorting 100 things, it works perfectly. If you want to sort a million things, you'd be here forever. And sometimes the right choice of an algorithm can make the total difference between success and failure in terms of efficiency. But we're not up to that stage yet, and hopefully you'll take some more courses and you'll deal more with efficiency. We are very happy in this class if you get it right. Okay? I don't care if it's the most efficient way. If it works, that's all that counts in this class. First class, more than happy.